I'm Shelley Schlender. This is MeAndMyDiabetes.com. In March of 2012, Stanford scientist Mike Schneider published a groundbreaking study in Cell that showed the most detailed biological profile of a person ever done. The profile includes 2 years of monthly data, meeting Schneider's DNA, plus measurements of the constantly changing rise and fall among proteins created by his genes, plus many of his metabolic byproducts, plus special immune system cells that point to infection or autoimmune disease, and more. In the middle of all this monitoring, Schneider developed type 2 diabetes, allowing researchers to track the molecular changes connected to that. The good news? He caught the condition early and changed his lifestyle so that not only did the researchers get to track his markers as blood sugars shot up, they also got to track his markers as his blood sugars gradually went down. And he unbecame a diabetic. Here's part one of a two-part conversation with Stanford geneticist Michael Schneider. It begins with Mike getting yet another blood draw in the name of science.
Hi, sorry to be running late. Mike Schneider. It turns out, so they want to, I want to give some blood. Is that kind of gross
you out?
Give
some blood. Oh, you know what? Let me get it on tape. Do you want your blood taken just in audio, or do you want it?
Yeah.
So you're rolling up your sleeve. You're going to have to narrate then as you're doing.
Okay, yeah, very good. So I'm rolling up my sleeve. We're doing a blood draw this morning so that we can do another sample of one of my omics profiles.
And what's your name?
My name is Michael Schneider. I'm chair of the Department of Genetics, and I'm also director of the Center for Genomics and Personalized Medicine.
It looks like you've done this so many times you don't even mind doing it anymore.
That's right. Not a problem.
And how about you? Oh, my goodness, you have out about 2,000 tubes to put the blood in. How many tubes are there here?
10-ish. About 10 tubes.
And who are you?
I'm Shin Lin. I'm a cardiology fellow at Stanford.
Okay. Hey. All right, my name is Roy Chen. I'm a postdoc in Dr. Schneider's lab. We co-authored the Cell paper.
How many times have you poked this guy?
I've never poked this guy because I'm not a medical doctor, but he's been poked many, many, many times. This is the 41st time now.
Okay, 44. I'd lost track.
And what all are you looking for as you, so poking 44 times in 2 years?
41.
Yeah.
So what we're looking for is we're trying to get a very detailed molecular profile of what's in my blood. And the idea is that we'll be able to follow health states much, much better this way than if we simply measure a few things as is currently done. So right now when you get a blood test, about 15 things are measured. But what we'd like to see happen in the future is that you're measuring thousands of things. We are measuring, in fact, 40,000 different components every time.
And what are the key breakdowns of the components? Standard stuff plus proteins plus DNA. What all are you measuring?
Yeah, so we measure RNA, which is what gets made from the gene. We measure protein, and we measure metabolites. We also measure antibodies to see if I'm making antibodies against anything that might suggest something's wrong.
Meaning antibodies against something you want to fight and antibodies against things you really don't want to fight because they're your body.
That's right, yeah. So we're mostly looking for the latter, things that are recognizing things we don't want to see.
Okay, you ready?
Do you want to go down there or up here?
Down here.
Okay.
I mean, I've had better luck.
Okay, very good.
All right, 1, 2, 3.
You even look as you're getting poked.
Yeah, I follow what's going on.
All right, so you have, it looks like, about 8 tubes.
I think it's 10 total. The different tubes are for different things. Most are for measuring the things I said, but there's one tube that's used for the antibodies and another tube that's used for standard medical tests, and then a series of 8 other tubes for the measuring all the different components I mentioned before.
Now you're using your technology for measuring the RNA, I'm assuming.
Yes, that's right. It's called RNA sequencing. It lets us measure literally the expression of every single gene in the body.
There's quite a few of them, and that's what, about 2,000 proteins, 20,000 proteins?
Yeah, well, it's 20,000 genes, but interestingly, each gene makes more than one protein. on average. So you can get different RNAs made from the same gene.
Are you using mass spec as part of this, or are you using,
Yeah, we use mass spec to follow about 4,000 proteins at each time point. And then we use very special tests to find some very interesting proteins called cytokines, which are quite biologically interesting. They don't get detected by mass spec. They're not very common in the blood. So you have to use special methods for that.
Are you using aptamer technology?
We're not, no. We're using, it's pretty much standard antibody assays, but maybe set up in a high throughput fashion.
Standard assays. So could Quest Lab do this for anybody, or are you special?
Well, right now they can't, but we think in the future this can be optimized so anyone can do it.
And in fact, the fact that you even got to see your own blood to see what's in your DNA plus your proteins is very special. Nobody gets to do that.
That's right. Nobody's certainly looked at things at this level before. So that's what makes this study unique.
Did you have to get special permissions to look at your own blood this closely?
You do. You have to enroll in a study. So I had to consent myself, essentially, to become part of the study. Although I actually rolled with a close collaborator, Kari Nadeau, and so she's in fact the one who consented me. But we hope to enlarge this study. We're now applying for approval to be able to look at lots of different people.
Did I read properly that you also looked at your mom's blood?
Yeah, that's correct. Well, we certainly sequenced her DNA, and we've done a limited analysis on her blood. So she was very a willing participant in the study. She's a very curious person by nature, and so wanted to take part in this.
So you had a somewhat normal person. I'm assuming she's not a scientist, or is she?
No, she's not a scientist. She's a retired school teacher.
And she was okay finding out all kinds of things about what's in her blood?
Haven't found anything so problematical for her yet. She's 83 years old and going strong, so we're not expecting anything we find out in her case is likely to be good news.
Now, just so that our listeners know, you're doing all of this conversation as tube after tube of blood is being drawn from your arm.
That's right.
No big deal.
No big deal.
Now, as part of this, you found out that you are not only prone to diabetes, but you are diabetic. Tell me first about the prone to diabetes part. What was that like to find out, and how did you find out?
So we discovered that early in the study when we sequenced my DNA, which suggested I was at high risk for diabetes. That was a bit of a surprise because I was not aware of that running in my family.
Now, right now, you are very trim. You're a very slim person. You look athletic. Were you this way when you found out that you were prone to diabetes?
That's right. I might have been slightly heavier, 15 pounds heavier, but generally I do not fit the profile of someone who has diabetes.
How old are you?
I'm now 56. We started the study when I was 54. So I guess I got the first news that I was prone at 54.
And then when did you find out how did you decide that actually you weren't just at risk for diabetes, but you might have it?
Well, what happened was I had been tracking all these things, as you see now. We're currently tracking my blood components. Okay, so we...
So right now you're holding the little piece of gauze to keep the blood from continuing to flow because they're done gathering.
Well, the flow was too low, so we're going to have to poke you again. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's fine. So...
This is all part of it.
Yes.
That's right. You're seeing real life.
Okay, as you get poked again.
I lost my train of thought because of the interruption here. But
well, so at some point you found out, you wondered, are you actually a diabetic instead of just potentially one?
Yeah, so what we've been doing is following my blood components all along, and in fact they had been running normal. But because of my genome sequence, I went in to get...
And when you say your blood components, you just mean your blood sugars? What were you saying that you were monitoring all along that was your clue?
Well, we were following everything but blood sugar in particular because of the diabetes concern. And
that's a test anyone can do.
It is, yeah. And in fact, it had been done routinely as well as by the methods we were using. But the key was when we went to... I went to a specialist who looks at glucose metabolism and went for a very fancy test. This is in Jerry Reaven's group. And she looked at me and certainly didn't think I was at risk for diabetes, nor did I at the time. But when we did that first measurement, it turns out my glucose level was high, even before we started the test.
How high was high?
Well, it was 127, which is a...
And that was fasting. That was going in without eating anything.
That's right. It was fasting. So, and we repeated the test and it was still high, and it went up even higher after that. It went up to 150. And probably more importantly, there's another test called hemoglobin A1C that was also high, which at first measurement was 6.4 and then later at 6.7.
Okay, Mike Schneider, you're...
Okay.
Look at this. You're smiling as he pokes you right in.
Well, yeah, I've had this done before, as I say.
Actually, the first hemoglobin A1C that you had before you even started this test would define you as a diabetic.
We didn't do an early one because there was no reason to think I was diabetic, and also because my glucose levels were quite low every time they had been measured.
And when you say low, what were they again?
They were in the 90 to 100 range, depending whether I was fasting or not. And it shows that it was quite normal because even after not fasting, the levels were pretty high. So
they started out in the 90s and the 100s, which is sort of pretty normal. And then at some point they went up, and then you went, maybe we should go check with Jerry Raven's group.
No, actually, they went up the first time I checked with Jerry Raven's group. So I just happened to go there for a fancy, this glucose metabolism test. And then that first measurement, it was high. And the reason it was high, we think, is because I went right after this viral infection I had.
That's right. You've written up how you seem to have had somewhat normal blood sugars, even though you had a risk for diabetes, and then you caught the flu or something else like that.
That's right. It was respiratory syncytial virus infection, which is a fairly common cold, but not as common as some others. Anyway, I caught this. It was a pretty nasty version. I was out for several days. And then shortly after is when I happened to go for this test, and that's when my sugar levels essentially skyrocketed. And they were up for several months before I changed my diet, I changed my exercise habits and such. And consequently, it took a while, but my levels of glucose gradually came down to normal. So it was temporary in the sense it lasted, well, several months before we started, and then took about 6 months to come down.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Thanks.
Sorry, I gotta run.
They need to run off to process the sample.
The action is always good. but I'm trying to figure out. Well, first of all, since you just told me that some things changed, and then you got diabetes, and then you ungot diabetes without taking medications. You just changed what you were doing. What did you change in how you ate and how you exercised?
Yeah, so I changed both my eating and exercise habits, and I also took baby aspirins every day, although I don't think the latter did a lot.
So you're not so enthused about the baby aspirin making a big difference, but what did you change about what you ate? What did you change about what you ate for breakfast?
Well, let's just start to say, before this was diagnosed, I was probably the world's worst eater. I ate lots of sweets, desserts, cakes, whatever, candy bars, etc. And so April 13th of last year, I completely cut all that out, and I haven't had desserts since, except in the form of fruits and things like that.
All right, then, what did you have for breakfast today?
Well, today I didn't have breakfast because we gave blood, and so that was another fasting sample, so...
And what did you have for breakfast yesterday when you did not give blood?
Let's see. I guess I had Cheerios with blueberries.
And how about for lunch? What do you generally have for lunch?
Yeah, I usually have either a salad with chicken, or sometimes they have some sushi here, or sometimes I have some chicken on rice sort of thing. I don't eat much pasta anymore. Again, I used to eat a lot more of that before all this was diagnosed. And as a consequence, I would say of this, my eating habits changing, as well as my increased exercise. So I pretty much always ride my bike to work. Today I didn't because I have to take someone somewhere. But as a general rule, I ride my bike to work. And when I increased my exercise, I would probably ride even more places and things like that. So I've doubled the amount of biking I do. And I also started running again, which I used to do but hadn't been doing up to the point this is all diagnosed.
You are exercising more. You've cut back on the total amount of carbohydrates, especially sugars, that you eat. Do you have a sense of what your ratio of fat to protein to carbohydrate is?
It is known in detail. I don't know off the top of my head.
Do you eat more fat? Do you eat fewer carbohydrate calories?
Oh, I definitely eat fewer carbohydrates overall. I eat more, probably more protein and more salads and things like that. So,
you're still keeping your fats pretty low. You're not a fat-eating person.
Well, I guess I eat some. I mean, I have high cholesterol and high triglycerides. So, and I do take simvastatin, which is a statin. And that has been very effective at lowering my cholesterol and triglycerides. But, you know, as I also do watch a little bit on that end. So I guess I eat some fat, but...
Here we are. We're getting to talk about the intimate details of what's inside your blood that are supposed to be private for most people unless they want to share it, and you're sharing it all with the world. And what are you finding out about your triglycerides and your cholesterol now that you've changed to a diet with less carbs for the sake of your diabetes?
Well, the cholesterol and triglycerides have probably mostly come down because of the statins. So I'm a good responder. We know that because they've come down even before I changed my diet.
Have they come down further now?
I think they're running around the same, to be honest. So what's come down the most with my changing the diet and exercise has been the sugar levels.
All right. So you didn't have to do a huge radical change of what you ate. You cut out the desserts and you exercised more. Some diabetics have to cut out all the carbs, but you didn't have to do that.
Well, I would say I've changed it pretty dramatically. I mean, the amount of pasta, I used to eat lots of pasta, lots of sweets, and again, all of that is pretty much gone. So it really has changed quite a bit.
Now tell me this, let's go back now that we've talked about that side of what you did. What kind of test did Jerry Raven's lab there do? Did it include not only your blood sugars, but your insulin levels and some other hormones that they checked to see what would happen as you were eating food? To see how all of those responded to a food?
Well, it was mostly that they follow your glucose metabolism using various agents that block uptake and things like that. So they're really following your different, just the details in which you metabolize glucose.
So they injected glucose into your blood, and then they also injected insulin to see how those two interact?
Yeah, that's correct. So they're following exactly how you metabolize blood, right? Or glucose, sorry.
Did they find out that your body was needing to use a lot more insulin to make things happen, or that it was putzing out and not having enough insulin?
Well, the nice thing was I was still classified as insulin sensitive. That is to say, I wasn't insulin resistance is often associated with diabetes. And in my case, I was still at least appeared to be insulin sensitive. And we think that's because I caught this early. Because I had been following myself all along, I could see when this first increase occurred. And we did do more tests before I changed my diet, and then probably more than a month went by. But ultimately, once it was diagnosed and very clear after repeated tests, I had high glucose, we did in fact change my diet and such. And I think it's because I caught it early that I was still insulin sensitive and I could do something about it. That's a general issue with disease. If you catch it early, you can usually control it by simple means. But if you catch it late, there's usually damage done, and then it's really problematical. Then had I waited a longer time, it's possible I would have needed drugs.
That's right. Most people catch diabetes years after they started having the problem.
Right. Now, under normal circumstances, as a healthy person, I would normally go to the doctor every 2 or 3 years, which means I wouldn't have caught this high glucose until probably a year and a half after it happened, something like that. And by then, there could have been significant damage and a problem. So the nice thing was it was caught early. I was able to manage it, and I've changed my lifestyle. And to be honest, I actually feel quite a bit healthier as a consequence.
Well, if you were insulin sensitive and your blood sugars were still going up, did that mean that your pancreas was stressed and not able to produce as much insulin?
Yeah, we don't know for sure why this occurred. My insulin production seems okay. We've measured that through various time points, but it may be more the way my body's utilizing and responding to the insulin that's the change.
Well, you know, there's some talk about how insulin is important for allocating and managing what is happening with your immune system, and that if you're sick, then your insulin needs to say, I need to go work with the white blood cells and make them work better.
Yeah, there's the relationship between insulin, getting sick through infection and various things is still an area that's not very well understood. So you're right, there's been lots of a correlation shown between getting sick and such. Certainly what people can say is that stress responses are very much associated with type 2 diabetes. Viral responses have not been shown, with the exception of some of the chronic cases. But I think what's particularly surprising about our study was it was very clear that this appeared after this nasty viral infection. So we did make that connection. It may just be that the viral infection caused a general stress, which in turn led to the increase in sugar and this type 2 diabetes onset. And these are some of the things we hope to understand better as we carry out more experiments and follow more people.
Mike Snyder, it sounds like you would be a believer of people saying, after I had surgery, after my father died and I had a divorce, all of a sudden I had diabetes. Those kind of stressors, you're inclined to pay attention to.
I think that's exactly right. We do think that that's a likely scenario, that after these situations, people are at risk for having this happen, and I think it would make a lot of sense for people to go in and get checked up at a more frequent basis after life stresses, shall we say.
Well, thank you for explaining those details of your story and how you got better. It's congratulations on feeling better. It was also interesting in your article for The Cell, reading the discussions about the potential for this and thinking about just how you caught this problem. Let's start with how you caught this problem. It sounds as though it didn't take anything fancy to catch it. We have the tools right now to discover whether somebody has early diabetes.
We do, by just following glucose. I think you can follow this. I think what was special in my case is I don't have any of the obvious features that people expect with diabetics. And I also didn't have an obvious family history.
Did you have symptoms that made you go, was your vision getting a little blurry? Were you thirsty more often or using the bathroom more often?
Not really, none of that so much. Certainly not before all this kicked in. And we did measure my vision and stuff after it kicked in, after my glucose level shot up, that is to say. For example, looking at glaucoma and such. And my retina, and everything looked fine. So again, we think we caught it right after it happened. So
you weren't showing any symptoms. You didn't notice a change in how you felt. It was just the blood sugar on a glucometer and also your hemoglobin A1C, your average blood sugars over 3 months, plus finger pricks to see what your blood sugar is.
That's right. So
well, then, but you did all this fancy DNA stuff and this protein stuff too, that you didn't need to diagnose it. But as a scientist, you're looking at it and saying, there's some other markers here that are fascinating.
That's right. First of all, if I knew I was going to get diabetes, I could have just only measured glucose, but we didn't know that going into the study. So we're trying to follow everything that's going on so that any potential disease that comes up, we might be able to see what kinds of early markers are there and then try and follow them in general. And the other thing I would say is that diabetes is probably clearly not one disease. It's probably hundreds of diseases. And if you look at it, everybody's a little different. I don't fit the classic case of someone getting diabetes. They generally have a much higher body mass index and such. And so what we think is, and others think this as well, that really diabetes is 100 diseases. So actually by following all these different markers, we hope to be able to stratify the disease better. That is, see how many different kinds there are.
Well, before we go on to that, just so people know, how tall are you and how much do you weigh?
Let's see, right now, I'm always 5'9", but at the start of the study, I was 162, now I'm about 147 pounds.
And so you are very fit. Your body mass index is putting you on the below average for body fat for a man, but in the fit category for that.
I like to think so.
All right. Now, as we talk about diabetes as a disease, I wonder whether you're thinking of diabetes as several diseases or if there's a new way to think about disease. For instance, did you find out during this time period that your inflammatory markers went up?
We did, because I went through these viral infections. I've been through four viral infections now, two initially when we published the study. And it's pretty clear that during each of these infections, you see a lot of inflammation going on, inflammatory markers going up. Interesting, after this RSV infection I mentioned earlier, there was a big inflammatory response at the time of the infection. There was one 2 weeks later, too, that may or may not have something to do with the onset of this.
I'm just kind of wildly guessing here as to what markers seemed most interesting. And many researchers say that what happens with chronic inflammatory markers is a clue to all kinds of things. Is that the marker that you were most intrigued with that changed, or was there something else?
Well, we're following everything. We don't know what it all means yet, to be honest. We'll still keep analyzing the data. We do see some very interesting pathways and things changing, markers that are showing up in these complex pathways. And so we're still trying to understand what it all means.
Can you tell me anything about it, or does it need to stay secret right now? It sounds like you've described what's happened with you, but there's no place someone can go to look at all these millions and millions of markers that you've been collecting.
We're not being secret about it. In fact, all the data are out there. Anybody can download and reanalyze the data themselves. Well, all I can say is right now, so we follow these 40,000 components, and we see things that are going up and down. The inflammation response is a no-brainer. We see that happening during these infectious times and just before the onset of the diabetes. And going back to your earlier question, you're right, inflammation has been associated with lots of different diseases. Now, that might be a downstream effect of the disease, like inflammation has been associated with cancer and other sorts of diseases as well. And so it's some of this may be downstream events, and that's fine. We do want to see that, but we also want to see the earliest events, because those are the things that are probably triggering the disease. And if we can catch those markers early and find markers for those and catch those early enough, and then also try and understand exactly what's going on, that might give us a better handle on how to treat the disease in its earliest possible state, catch and treat, I should say.
And also, you're indicating that in your case, you didn't have to add any diabetes medications, you didn't have to start injecting insulin. You changed your lifestyle. Was it motivating to see this happening to you, to say, maybe I don't want to eat all that ice cream?
It was clear I had a health issue and I had to deal with it, so I dealt with it. To be honest, the only thing I really do miss out of changing my diet is the ice cream. But anyway, that's a small price to pay for maintaining your health. So
there is a potential that this kind of information might motivate more people to take care of their health. And your discussion of what you found out was interesting that way. Right now, the FDA does not allow people to know all of this cool stuff about what's happening in their blood. Right now, we don't have affordable ways that people can regularly check their hemoglobin A1Cs and their insulin levels and that kind of more complex test. That's out of the price range of most people. So we have both the fact that we don't have the information available. It's barred from most people to find out all that you found out. Plus, it's expensive.
Yeah, well, I don't know how much it's truly barred in the sense that you can't do. I mean, it's barred in the sense that it's just not accessible. These are the latest technologies. We're using $1 million mass spectrometer. We're using that's for measuring the proteins. We're using a $600,000 mass spectrometer for measuring the metabolites and the whole sequence. So the setup cost for this was enormous. But now we can analyze these samples for around $2,500 a piece, although we're analyzing them in exquisite detail.
$2,500 a piece, give or take a little bit of research and development cost up front.
Yeah, a lot of research.
Physician who specializes in weight loss and the treatment of heart disease and diabetes. For many of his patients, Dr. Gerber recommends a high-fat, low-carb diet. You can find out more about Jeff at his website, denversdietdoctor.com. For more discussions like this, check out my website, which is meandmydiabetes.com.
You know, I would like to see in the future this become quite inexpensive, so it could be done as a home test, quite frankly. So instead of pricking yourself and measuring one simple thing, which is glucose, you can measure 5,000 things and actually get a much clearer picture of what's going on.
A much clearer picture about what's going on is important to you. I'm thinking about what's going to happen with the people that are in your next test. You've mentioned that you're going to try to do this with a broader range of people. Non-scientists even?
That's right. Well, we'd certainly like to make sure everyone we talk to who would enroll in the study understands what it's all about and what they're doing. So they need some level of sophistication to be able to comprehend what we want to do.
Now, most studies are done in a double-blinded placebo style, meaning that you don't get to know the person individually as much as you have them be a data point. And they don't get to know what their data says about them. They just get to know the fact that they were part of a general study. In your case, it was motivating for you to hear what your information was. Are you planning to do this study in the double-blinded way, or are you planning to do it where you're going to inform people what their blood says about them as you go along?
Well, I personally would like to inform them about what their blood says as we go along, simply because it, I think it can help them rather than hurt them if their glucose shoots up or something. But to back up a little bit, the study will be focused primarily on pre-diabetics. People are at risk for diabetes or starting to show some high levels of glucose. So they will, a certain fraction of them, we know already just from statistics, will convert and become diabetics. About a third will. We are going to be following an at-risk population. And we will follow them in time, and presumably, like me, they will move along at their current levels, and then for a subset, they may actually see their glucose shoot up, and we'd like to see what's happening in those earliest events, what kinds of life stresses that's associated with, if any, and that sort of thing. So
you want to find out what's happening in their lives individually, so you can tie that back in with what you see. Now, are you just going to tell them about the markers that they could get by going to a doctor to hear about, like, their blood sugars and maybe their insulin levels and their A1Cs? Or will you also tell them about this wide world of inflammatory markers and say, here's what we're seeing here with your inflammatory markers, too?
Well, we'll tell them what we understand. What we don't understand, I'm not sure there's a point in telling them. If there is a strong inflammation response and we see that it's associated with a health risk, I guess we probably would tell them. I assume if there's a strong inflammation response, it is associated with something. And so we'd want to figure out what that something is.
Now, you want to see this happen for the sake of the people, to see if it will motivate them to get more information. You're going to get research information from it. I believe that the FDA gets nervous if they think someone's getting information about something that's a non-approved medical device. And some of the data that you're getting is not approved and reference checked by the FDA yet. So how much are you going, there's a little bit of a gray area here. How do you work with that?
Yeah, so we would only return results through the physician. That is to say, so it really is, I should back up a little bit. You're absolutely correct. This really is a research project, and the primary goal is to study what's going on in the blood of these individuals and associate it with any other sorts of changes that are going on in their life, viruses, life stresses, things like that. So that really is the primary objective. But we think it's valuable to, you are allowed to, if you find things that occur during the course of a study, you can relay that to the physician, who in turn can relay it to the patient. And so, in fact, that's how we would handle this data. We're not trying to circumvent any rules about the sort of thing. The goal would really be to return any research findings that might help the health of an individual during this study.
That's a fascinating study. So you'll give to the patient through their physician, and does that mean a Stanford physician who's in charge of the project, or does that mean their personal physician? Let's get that figured out first.
Well, we'd have a physician already identified who'd be part of this, and so I think they would be the one to return this information, again, as needed and as desired. I mean, some patients may not want to know anything, and that's fine. We will just go on as we go on. But if they do want to know some things that are related to their health, I think we can certainly tell them that. That would be the plan.
All right, so that means that the 30,000 or so measures that you take each time, you researchers will look at every single one of them. For the ones that make sense and have more history behind them, that the physician can explain to the patient, the physician can tell their patient what's useful to that person.
That's right. And in the case of the people we're talking about, since they're pre-diabetics, the number one thing we'd look out for would be glucose levels. And so we can certainly see their glucose levels go up. We can tell the physician. The physician can then suggest that they go get additional tests like hemoglobin A1C or what have you, and see if this and confirm anything. They can do an official clinical test to see that anything we discover in our research project is in fact real, and they can use that information.
You were very eloquent in explaining what you think the potential is for this, for the future, a future where if people find things out early enough and they get good enough information, they can be motivated to take the right kind of care for that person.
That's right. I think most complex diseases are, as the name sounds, complex. And diabetes is one of those, schizophrenia. There are many diseases like this. And they're probably not one simple disease. They're probably, again, lots of different diseases. And so if we can understand better how many different diseases there are, we can treat each appropriately. So in the case of diabetes, for example, some people do respond well to anti-inflammatory drugs. And so those do incredibly well with that. But then there's another group that's completely unresponsive to this. And likewise, there's a group that respond to a drug called metformin, and there's another group that doesn't respond. So it seems like everybody's a little bit different, and if we can just figure out how many different diseases there are, we would know which ones to treat which way, and that could be very valuable then in very rapidly deciding the right treatment for the right person.
Mike Snyder, I can envision a time where instead of telling someone, you have schizophrenia, you have diabetes, you could say, you have a disease that tends to really affect the inflammatory pathways and the signaling that goes to your hippocampus. And if we can settle that down and get more normal signaling, you're probably going to feel better.
Yeah, we'd hope it would turn out as simple as that. That would be a great outcome of all of this. Can't guarantee that that'll be the case, but that's certainly what we hope.
And that's kind of how you're thinking, that you're seeing how these markers change and that sometimes they target one organ or one system, but you're looking at the markers as the way to do it instead of looking at, it's a different way of looking at a person.
That's right. It's really to understand what's going on in an incredible molecular detail, if you will. So it's really zooming in at a resolution that's never been done before.
Well, thank you for being the first proof of concept person who's ever done this publicly. Do you think that there's plenty of people doing this behind the scenes right now?
Not at this level, because it requires a certain level of sophistication. Most people can't analyze DNA, RNA, proteins, metabolites at the same level our particular group can. So, and our collaborators, I should say. So we have some really terrific collaborators with you and Ashley, Russ Altman, Atul Butte, Mark Gerstein, and others, Kari Nadeau I mentioned earlier. And it's really a very unique team that's been able to come together to do this study. And so you really need the right expertise to be able to put all this together. But I hope that someday it will become a lot more standard so that it can be done routinely for everyone.
How soon is someday?
Well, that's always hard to predict. It's very difficult to get from the lab to the clinic and predict this in real terms. Usually it takes a lot longer than people think, often 15 or 20 years. I think some form of this could come out in much less time, but not analyzing 40,000 components. And it may be we don't need to analyze 40,000 components. Maybe we really only need to analyze 2,000 critical ones that can tell us everything that's going on in a so-called health state. So with that kind of information, it could be quite it could be a lot simpler to design a test for the future that specifically looks at those 2,000 things. And again, I don't know how long you'd have to figure out how to do it exactly, and then you'd have to have it approved by the FDA and such, and that would take some time. But you know, if there's a demand for it, these things have a way of moving pretty quickly. So just like right now, a lot of people are getting their genome sequenced, which you never would even thought of 10 years ago.
But you know, genome sequencing to me isn't as exciting as what you've done, because once you know what your genes are, they're not going to be changing very much for the rest of your life. But your proteins and your metabolites, your hormones, the fatty acids that are in your body, all of these other things, they change based on what you do and what comes and hits you. And so those are changing all the time, as opposed to your DNA, which is holding steady.
That's right. So I think your genome and getting your genome sequence is an important part of this, because it does lay the groundwork for what you might look out for. But you're absolutely right. I think it's only part of the equation, and the bigger part is trying to follow all the other stuff.
How often do you think someday you'd like to see people measure this stuff?
Well, one possible scenario that I would like to see, but not everyone would agree with, is that there'd be a simple home test, just like you do for your glucose, where instead of, again, pricking yourself and measuring one thing, glucose, you prick yourself and you measure 5,000 things. And you need a very robust test. You need that handled in an appropriate fashion so people don't mislead themselves to think, oh, I'm following my health and that's good enough. But it could help you imagine a scenario where you do this once a month or once every 2 months. Suddenly you could catch things much, much earlier than, again, if you go every 2 or 3 years like most healthy people do. And the convenience would make it quite attractive. And I think in my mind, this would be a great outcome of this, that people could self-monitor and catch a lot of stuff early. It wouldn't replace them going to the doctor for their annual physical or biannual physical, what have you, but it could supplement that and add a lot more information that could, again, greatly help their help them monitor their health. And again, if they see something funny, they could go to a doctor much earlier and get it confirmed. And then, again, catching disease early is really the key.
All right, so someday you'd like to see a test that people can do once a month that catches 5,000 different things at once, and that if they sign up for a $1,000 plan, they can do this once a month and get all that information.
Yeah, something like that would be quite attractive. I think a lot of people would want to do that.
I'm Shelley Schlender. This interview with Mike Schneider was recorded in April of 2012. You can find more interviews like this at meandmydiabetes.com. Thanks to Walt Schlender for the music.